Shoes. Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Monday, March 15th, 2009. And this is the Christogenia Open Forum call. Open Forum means that hopefully somebody will call so that we could have a call. That's, I'm not twisting anybody's arms, but that's just the way it is. While you're off, maybe my son will call in. How you doing, Billy? Good to see you here. Well, I managed to blow up Eli's, I hate doing it, I really do, but if there's one thing I can't countenance, it's a Paul basher. That's the first step the Jews make in subverting Christianity, is turning people to Paul bashing. Get rid of Paul, and by necessity, Luke has to go. Luke is the most prophetic of the four Gospels. There's no doubt. John might be the most enigmatic, and we love John, but Luke is the most prophetic. But if you get rid of Paul, Luke loses all credibility. And so does 2 Peter. 2 Peter goes also. So there goes half the New Testament. A lot of people claim that the Paul bashers claim that Peter didn't write 2 Peter, but that's a lie. Peter, 2 Peter, the Greek is very rustic, and 1 Peter is very eloquent. And I'm sure that Peter wrote them both and just had a scribe to write 1 Peter for him. But if one of those gospels, if one of those epistles is called into question, it can't be 2 Peter, it has to be 1 Peter, because Peter was an admittedly rustic man. And that's how mainstream scholars feel also. So 2 Peter is definitely cannot be. I mean, they both, according to all the church fathers, were written by Peter. There's no doubt in my mind. But if you question one of them, it can't be 2 Peter, which testifies of Paul. And the Revelation also testifies of Paul's work. Anybody that studies the matter will find that Paul is blameless, and that a Paul basher is only giving in to the deceit of the Jews. Who are the real Paul bashers and the original Paul bashers? Why did the Jews bash Paul? Because Paul understood that the nations that he brought the gospel into, that those nations were the actual descendants of Abraham, the physical, lineal, genetic descendants of Abraham. He proves that in Romans chapter 4 and chapter 8, in Galatians chapter 3 and chapter 4, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beyond doubt. And once that is understood, that destructs the entire facade and pretense the Jews put up about their own identity, is destroyed in Paul of Tarsus. So the Jews would like to destroy Paul and use every deceit possible in order to do so. Another thing Paul talks out about that the Jews absolutely hate is homosexuality. In fact, only 3 times in the New Testament is homosexuality, which I should just call sexual deviancy because that's what it is. Only 3 times in the New Testament is it condemned. All 3 times by Paul. And we know that the Jews, being the authors of all sin and the greatest purveyors of homosexuality in this day and age, would just hate anybody who condemns homosexuality. Thus we have the Jewish condemnation of Paul of Tarsus. Anybody who's a Paul basher is doing the work of the Jew. Period. There's no doubt. So when Clayton Douglas came into Eli's Forum Sunday, Clayton Douglas happens to be the subject of about 2/3 of my paper, William Fink versus the Paul bashers. So this being the first time I had a chance to confront him since I'd been home. I certainly couldn't pass on the opportunity. So I blew up Eli's forum. But that's okay. I don't regret it. It's going to work out for the best. By the end of the program Sunday, there was a little conciliatory move. And Clayton invited me onto his radio program. And I accepted the invitation. So I'll be there on March 30th at 10 a.m. on Blog Talk. The link is on the front page of Chris Degania. It's not fancy right now. I just wanted to get the info up there. There'll be a better link before the program. And I'll verify and make sure it's right. And my Firefox is froze up. I said, oh, there it goes. Hello, Bruce. Hello, David.
Hi, Bill. My Firefox is working good. How are you doing?
Oh, I must have clicked on your name about four times to unmute you.
Oh, I just got on. I'm just opening up the chat room screen now. Bruce is coming on. We were just talking. So, yeah. So you talk a little bit about what do you got online for tonight? Anything on schedule? Or
no, I never have anything on schedule for this. I mean, it's very rare I have anything on schedule for this program. I actually got a real nice email from a guy who's a he's a fellow New Yorker, and I just didn't get the chance to answer it, or I would have invited him here tonight. He wants to talk. He didn't suggest that he wants to talk publicly, but the things that he wants to talk about, this is probably the ideal forum. And if I get a chance to get to his email this week, I will probably invite him here maybe next Monday or the following.
Great, yeah. Well, he's in New York?
Yeah, he's a nationalist, and he's not really a Christian. And I don't blame a lot of people for not being Christians when the only alternative is mainstream Christianity.
Yeah, well, that was my problem all my life. I mean, if you want to call it a problem, it was my condition. As a kid, you get a gut feeling, and I don't know, maybe I'm intuitive or something in some way that I'd never thought of it that way, but, you get around somebody and you get a bad feeling, You get those, what they call vibes or something, or even as a kid, I'd go into these churches and I thought, hey, this isn't real. What is this? It's all plastic kind of behavior. I didn't like it. So I never got affiliated. When I got to be 19, I joined up with the Catholic Church. What a debacle that was. But anyway, got out of that. So I can understand not joining in with a church. I think that's what's happened to a lot of people. They never heard anything real. Coming to them from people that they were presented to as being the caretakers of your soul and take lead you to God and salvation, and it never seemed like any of them were doing anything like that to me.
Well, right, they're pusillanimous. That's I'm putting it nice. I want to use the first three letters in another word. That they're that they cave in to every sort of evil. That's what they do. And they really teach Dharma, that this Hindu love everybody theology that's absolutely sickening and absolutely unscriptural. And I had a lot more, with my time in separated from society, I had a lot more success reaching out to guys that were, apostates, but conscious that something was wrong in the world and somewhat racially conscious. I had a lot more success with guys like that, that could actually stand up for themselves and wonder what was happening than for the guys that went over to the chapel every Sunday and sang Kumbaya with the Negroes.
Oh, boy.
I had no success at all with those people.
Yeah, I don't know how they allow that. I don't know how it happens, that's all. It's a puzzle to me. But it does, and it's the way it's worked out. Bruce and I were talking about something on as far as what we call Christian identity. How How was that preserved, the identity understanding, you might call it, you know, like Christ told him at the Pharisees, you know, you're from Satan and I'm from God, and never the twain shall meet, and that's the way it is, and you do the work of your father, the devil, and that's why you don't understand me and all that. Well, how, and Paul went on, Bruce pointed out, well, Paul carried that message through, but it's been lost, hasn't it? Been lost over the centuries, but who carried it on?
It was hidden in plain sight. Nobody carried it on. It was hidden in plain sight. The Catholic Church.
Who was aware of it? Let's put it that way. Anybody through the centuries?
As far as I know, until John Wilson and Sharon Turner and certain early scholars of what became British Israel, nobody, as far as I know, nobody was aware of it. I mean, there were church people that knew in their hearts that they were the children of Israel. There's no doubt. And if you go read the writings,
but they couldn't point it out scripturally like you're doing now.
They only believed it through faith because they knew that the children of Israel in the world would be Christians. They didn't know how. And the replacement theology was not the theology, the prevailing theology. They just knew they were. But nobody had the linear history down. None of them did. Nobody ever did. It's been hidden in plain sight. I mean, you go to 1 Corinthians 10. What's Paul saying to those people?
Bill?
Yes.
Bill?
I'm listening.
Yeah, Bill, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, my reception of you is cutting out quite a bit. I don't know if anybody else is.
Well, I think it might be you. Bruce, do you have a problem hearing me?
No, I can hear you both fine.
Bruce, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, can
sir,
you hear me okay?
David,
yes,
I think
sir.
It's your phone.
I'm getting Bruce in. Now, I heard you there, Bill. Anyway... I just said I wanted to let you. I didn't know if it's something, a problem there or something with. I haven't had that happen before. It might be my phone.
But you know, the Christian identity message to really receive the full blow of it, you can expect persecution.
Well, absolutely. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
The truth is supposed to divide. Think not that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I've come not to bring peace, but a sword.
Mm-hmm.
And father will be divided against daughter-in-law and son-in-law, and mother will be divided against daughter. And the only, when you read those verses, the only Christianity that has ever fulfilled those words is Christian identity. So it must be true. And it's not a self, it's not a self-realizing fulfillment. It's not.
Yeah. On the contrary, it's that the ending of that individualism is more of a collective concern for your kinsmen as a whole.
Well, right. Individualism is we've always had elements of it in our society, but it's really stressed by the Jew. Stardom.
Yeah.
That's stressed by the Jew.
It's more of a recent Jew cycle battle.
It's part of the doctrines of the Frankfurt School. I mean, Sword Brethren and I proved that.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin McDonald wrote about it at great length. Long before I ever knew about it.
Yeah, this personal salvation is a mask. It's a phony baloney, embrace the Jew BS. All this.
Well, Judeo-Christianity is Talmudism for the masses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. It's Jew. I mean, the Jews think they're their own Messiah, and the Judeo-Christians are worshiping them. So Judeo-Christianity is basically Talmudism for the rest of the people.
Yeah.
Talmudism for the goy. That's exactly what Judeo-Christianity is. They forget about God and worship the Jew, who believes he's his own Messiah. And it's their rabbis admit that.
Yeah.
David, are you still with us?
Dave? Oh, where'd Dave go?
I don't know. I think he's having problems with his phone.
Hmm.
Well, anyway, I just wanted to make the point that I hate blowing up Eli's forum. I really do. I hate being a distraction. His show is a good show. Jeremy Visser is a good, it has a lot of good ideas and good knowledge, and I just hate doing it, but I can't countenance a Paul Basher. I can't let it go by. I can't let it pass. I can't do it.
Well, I think Paul stressed to contend for the faith. You know, I mean, you're going to have to come against people who are contrary to the whole context and putting the order of the whole Word of God in its right place, and you have to stand up against it. You can't just be a wimp and, yeah.
Well, absolutely. If I don't say anything and it passes and I don't see him for 4 more months, well then he gets that. I can't give him that bye for 4 more months.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, Bill Cooper, for instance, his wife was an Oriental, right?
William Cooper? Yeah, I never knew that.
Yeah. Anyways.
That about disqualifies him from writing about Christianity.
Well, yeah, but he gave a whole talk on talking about the Jews and talking about people that talk bad about the Jews, and he was a Jew sympathizer.
Well, that's 6 strikes.
Well, the thing of it is, you know, not only him, but what's that? A bunch of these clowns like Jordan Maxwell, you know, sleeping with Zachariah Sitchin. All kinds of these people embracing, you know, the one who makes us into harlots. There has to be a sharp double-edged sword, and you have to defend that. You can't let it.
Well, right, you can't. And I don't get upset by Zechariah Sitchin. I get upset when Christians follow Zechariah Sitchin. That upsets me.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, Zechariah Sitchin, he's no better off than the average novelist. I mean, Jew novelist. It's all a scam. But I get upset when Christians follow clowns like that. And that's what he is. He's a straight clown. I mean, the whole thing's a deception.
Well, these Canaanite Edomites have always led our forefathers astray. And it's the same. They're doing the same carnival show. The same enchanting business. It hasn't changed.
Well, I hope somebody else calls in. I mean, I'd like to have a program tonight. Halfway interesting one, anyway. I'm going to have to start singing something if nobody calls in. That'll encourage somebody.
Maybe I can sing. I can probably sing better than you, Phil.
I'm sure.
I'm just kidding.
Warrior's going to call in. Warrior 0351 is going to call in.
You know, that I think the best talk I've heard Yahweh gave through the vessel called Bill Fink was that one on the marriage relationship in Judah. I mean, that was excellent.
Well, you know, Clifton's writing at length on a marriage relationship right now, and it's actually one of the most poorly understood facets of Christianity, even in Israel identity.
Mm-hmm.
The whole story of the Bible revolves around the marriage relationship between Yahweh and Israel. That's the whole purpose.
And the glass slipper fits perfectly.
That's why Paul mentioned it in Romans 7, I think it's 2 Corinthians 11 or 1 Corinthians 11. He mentioned it at least 3 times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all through the Old Testament, all the Christians spoke about it too. In Hosea, all the types and shadows of marrying the harlot.
Right. Like, you know, I'm glad you used that term, all the Christians in the Old Testament. Because even a lot of people in identity would say, oh, they're not Christians in the Old Testament. Well, damn right they are, because the Old Testament religion is Christianity before Christ.
Yeah, well, yeah. Jew psychobabble is, you know, the enemy likes to divide too.
And Elpidios is a straight idiot. Two brides, the bride of Christ. Where's the bride of Christ ever mentioned in the Bible? Show me that. Where's that verse? Where's that verse, you clown? The bride of Israel. The bride of Israel does not, that term does not appear in the Bible. Israel is the bride of Christ. There's only one bride, and there's only one husband. The bride of Israel. Incredible. The bad ideas some people have. Where's that in the Bible? The bride of Israel.
They're watching too many Disney cartoons, maybe.
Yeah, well, more like they're listening to too many Jews.
Well, it's the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. You're right.
Yeah.
Hey, Bill.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been listening. I got my sound back, I hope. why don't you go over that a little bit, that bride of Judah, the bride of Yahweh, and cover some of those points. I understand it. I mean, no problem. I like to get some of the finer points meshed out, you know, or meshed around and mixed in. And I don't quote verses like you do at all, but I can listen and put it together. They're very, you know, I'm a listener, and I like to read too. But if you go over that a little bit, where did that that was started way back in the old writings too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I covered it in 45 minutes. I did a, I thought, well, other people thought, I shouldn't say what I thought. Other people thought it was a pretty thorough, succinct presentation about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
And it was two-pronged. First, I wanted to prove that Judah was divorced and married and divorced to Yahweh as well as Israel, which is true. And a lot of identity pastors say, oh, Judah was never divorced. Well, if Judah wasn't divorced, then they're basically accusing Yahweh of committing the same sin that Adam committed. Because Judah's called the harlot about 50 times in Scripture. And a man can't keep a harlot for a wife, according to the law, Deuteronomy chapter 25.
Oh, yeah.
So all those people that say Judah was never divorced, they're committing, I mean, to me, it's a blasphemy. Yahweh would keep a harlotress wife.
Yeah, and then they steer folks. No, I'm sorry. They steer folks to say that the Jew, the double whammy.
Right.
You know?
Basically, it's the remnant that was left. That was a matter of prophecy. That was never divorced. But the remnant was of more tribes than just Judah. I mean, we think of just Judah because Judea and Judah definitely dominated the remnant. But look at Anna of the tribe of Asher, who was in the temple, and kept the law, and she was a prophetess. So there you go. The remnant was more than Judah because there was at least one person in the tribe of Asher there. And Anna, I think, would have to have parents. And they were probably in the temple sometimes too.
Was Anna the mother of John the Baptist? you talk to?
No, Anna was the prophetess. She's mentioned in the first chapter of Luke, I think, towards the end. Or maybe it's the second chapter of Luke. It's in there somewhere. David, I don't know where all the scriptures are. I know what they say, but I don't know where they all are.
What was the cause of the divorce? I mean, what
Well, the cause of the divorce, all right, Israel's married to Yahweh. That marriage ceremony is in Exodus chapter, well, it's primarily in Exodus chapter 19. I mean, it spills over in other chapters.
Okay.
That was a special relationship. Yahweh took Israel as his precious possession, and they agreed to keep his law as a condition of that relationship. So that's a prenuptial agreement. That's the first. That's the world's first prenuptial agreement recorded, Exodus chapter 19, and you know, the rest, the subsequent chapters. That's the world's first prenuptial recorded prenuptial agreement right there. Now, Israel makes this agreement, so they bind their descendants to this agreement. And many generations later, well, actually, some of them didn't take that long, that they broke the agreement by worshiping other gods. Now, what we don't understand, and I wrote about it at length in Broken Cisterns, is that the worship of other gods at that time also meant the participation in the pagan fertility rituals. So to worship other gods necessitated race mixing. And that's evident all throughout the Bible. And I prove it from other sources, and including the Bible and other sources. But it's also evident in the Bible where everywhere it says you can worship our gods and we can take your daughters for our sons and you take our sons for your daughters. And yet, you know, how many agreements, how many times did the Canaanites make that offer to the Israelites? Several. And they, Yahweh always rebuked that. Now, when Israel plays the harlot, they're divorced. They're put out of the land. And that word has a double meaning in Greek. It basically means to be put away from one's fatherland, to be destroyed and driven out from one's homeland. And that's Greek writers, secular Greek writers use that word, apolumi, in that term, with that meaning. And that's right in Liddell and Scott, the Greek lexicon. So Israel's divorced. But Yahweh, now Israel, if you look at the law, is liable to die. The nation, being the wife of Yahweh, is liable under the law to death. Because that's the penalty in the law for adultery. But Yahweh makes two promises in the prophets. First, he promises that he will betroth Israel. This is Isaiah 54. It's in Hosea 2:7. That he will betroth Israel to him forever. And he promises that Israel will return to him, to her first husband, Hosea chapter 2. And he also promises that Israel will never cease from being a nation, Jeremiah 31. So how does he fulfill the law? He comes here and dies. Romans chapter 7. The wife is not... Paul's not given a lesson in domestic relations in Romans chapter 7. That ain't about a man and a wife in their house in Corinth or in Thebes. That's about the relationship between Yahweh and Israel. That's what Paul's explaining. That's what Romans chapter 7 is about. That's not about common domestic relations. The whole discourse of Romans. Romans chapter 4, the promise to Abraham and Abraham's belief his descendants would become many nations. Romans chapter 5, Romans chapter 6, the promise to Adam, that Adam was the first Adam and fell and Christ was the second Adam. And Paul equates man and Adam. The word man is equated with the word Adam in that chapter. And Romans chapter 7, the marriage relationship between Israel and Yahweh. That the wife is not freed from the law unless the husband dies. Well, that's what happened on the cross. That's how Christ fulfilled the law. There's no other explanation. There's no other valid explanation. I don't care how hard you want to turn the scriptures, search the scriptures. The law is not fulfilled unless the husband dies or the wife dies. Well, the wife was promised she would live forever, Jeremiah 31. So the husband died.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's good. Good presentation summation. That's great. I've got a better grasp of that. Thanks, Bill.
Well, I did. If you go back and listen to that tape, it was a Saturday night.
Yep.
It was the last Saturday night that I was on. I was alone because Eli took off. I think it was the second or third Saturday in February. I think it was the weekend of the 12th.
I'll find it.
Yeah, I think that's right. It goes all the way to the language in Revelations. You have left your first love. It's always Israel he's speaking to, not...
Well, the first love of the Ephesians is basically the Christianity that Paul brought to Ephesus because he founded that, that assembly.
Mm-hmm.
But the marriage supper of the Lamb in Revelations 19, the city that comes down from heaven and on its gates are the names of the 12 tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Revelations 20, I think, or maybe... Maybe 21.
One of those gates isn't named Hutu?
No, there's no Hutus and Tutsis on those gates. There's only the 12 tribes of the children of Israel.
Oh, I see. Well, they'll probably start putting that in the Jew World Translation, no?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. The 12 tribes of the children of Nigeria or something. Oh, no, what a pity. Well, if you're not one of those children of Israel, if you're not from one of those 12 tribes, there ain't no way you're getting into that city. I got news for you. It ain't happening. David, if you go to christagenia.org/site/YCP program, that's my Yahweh's Covenant People, the Saturday Night Talk Show program archive.
Yeah.
You'll see it. It's the February 13th show.
Right. Okay, I'll get that. Yeah. Right, thanks. And I've looked at that article, Broken Cisterns. It's been a long time, 7 months since I've...
Yeah, it's been a long time for me. I don't think I've read that in 8 years. I don't go back and reread my own writing. It's something I probably should. It basically proves that the idol worship, the pagan idol worship, the pagan religions were all about race mixing. That's the whole gist of the it's a two-part series.
Interspersed with this lifestyle, you might call it, that the Israelites were living through, and mixed in with the enemy at that, the aliens at that time, then they had their prophets, the Israelites' prophets. Then they came along then when things got to a crescendo and getting out of line, the people were straying away from their agreement, the covenant, and they warned them, told them this is going to happen, that's going to happen, and so forth, as the prophets. And then they were murdered by the aliens. The prophets were the ones that killed them.
Well, when we look, the Old Testament does not actually record the murder of any of the prophets or the death of any of the prophets. We're told later that they were murdered. And when you look back at the Old Testament, that there's only a couple of instances where priests of Yahweh are being put to death. And the two that come to mind that I know of are Doug the Edomite. That, Saul looked for a man to kill the priests of Yahweh. And none of the men would do it. So Doeg the Edomite, Doeg, D-O-E-G, it's spelled in the King James, the Edomite, volunteered to kill the priests of Yahweh for Saul. And he went and killed a bunch of them. And the next time is Jezebel. And Jezebel is, her father is a shady character. And I'm going to turn to history because this history is known. It comes from Josephus. It comes from Against Appian, which is a treatise that Josephus wrote. And there was a guy named, let me get this right. I can't remember his name. Wow. Hecataeus of Abdera. That was his name. And Hecataeus, he had translated the ancient archives of Tyre, the Chronicles of Tyre. He translated them into Greek. And I wish I had them. I would pay all the whole couple hundred dollars in my savings account to read those. I'd give away my computer to read the Tyrian archives. I'm telling you, that they must be so full of good stuff, but it's lost to us. And Josephus quotes from parts of it, but the work is lost to us. It disappeared. We know about it from fragments and Josephus and a couple other places, but it's gone. Well, they were just like they were basically like the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel and Judah. But they were for Tyre, the ancient city. I would love to have those and read those, especially in Greek. Well, anyway, from the archives of Tyre that Joseph has quoted, we know that Hiram, the king of Tyre, about four generations after him, a pagan priest named Ethbaal, rose up and killed one of the Hiram's descendants who sat on the throne, and he took over the throne of Tyre as a tyrant. And he is the father of Jezebel. And you don't read that story in the Bible. So now a pagan, Jezebel was the daughter of a pagan priest on Tyre. So that indicates to me that it's not a given, but it's possible that she was part Canaanite. It's possible, but I wouldn't say it with any assurance. Because we could have Israelite pagan priests in that period also.
But you said her father was
Ethbaal, and that means man of Baal. And he was a pagan priest who slew one of the descendants of Hiram that sat on the throne of Tyre and took it for himself.
So he was a pagan. Was he an Edomite, you mean?
Well, I'm saying it's possible, but I can't say it with any certainty.
All right. Yeah.
Okay, and Jezebel was responsible for killing many of the priests of Yahweh. And Yahweh said she would be eaten by dogs, and she was. And she is used as an example for teaching the children of God fornication, which is race mixing. And that's in Revelation chapter 2 or maybe chapter 3. It's in a message to the seven churches. And Jezebel's used an example of that. So she was she killed the priests of Yahweh, and she was a race-mixing whore. And he was a pagan priest that killed the real king of Tyre and married his daughter to Ahab. Jezebel was the wife of Ahab. And she was not the only wife of Ahab. Ahab had legitimate wives whom he had many sons and daughters by. But his sons with Jezebel became the kings of Israel for two kings in a row. And they were both killed very quickly.
How's that come about? Is that the people rose up?
No, they were killed in battle. They were both killed in battle.
Oh, all right. Mm-hmm.
I'm certain they were both killed in battle. Ahab had 70 sons, and he had daughters, and they weren't all from Jezebel. But the two men that became king in Israel after Ahab, they were from Jezebel, and they were both very short-lived. I don't remember the particulars. I mean, it's been a couple of years since I've read the books of Kings and Chronicles. I'm sorry. You just can't have it all. It's not possible. It's too much.
What do they have on the Chronicles of Tyre? Is there anything they're speculative?
Well, they're gone. But Josephus quotes from them.
And what he quotes is, what is it, like another biblical narrative from Tyre, you're saying? Or
well, it
like
would
that?
Have been very much like the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel and Judah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it didn't make it into the Bible. I believe it didn't make it into the Bible because Yahweh wanted us to be blind as to who we are. If we'd have had the Chronicles of Tyre, we would basically have records of the colonies that the Phoenicians founded, and we'd know that they were Israelite. And I believe, and I know that anyway, and I think I have papers on my site that demonstrate that. But we would have some of the missing links, that's for sure. But they're gone.
Not a chance they're lying around someplace.
Well, there is a chance that they're lying around. I mean, they existed when Josephus wrote 2,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and probably about 2,140 years ago.
They're probably in a paper.
I'm sorry, 1,940 years ago. But there's always the proverbial Vatican basement, right?
There you go.
I'll just blame it on the Vatican basement again.
No, I said the Knesset.
Yeah, there's always the proverbial Vatican basement. But I don't, they were quoted by Josephus, but I don't know of any of the other ancients that actually referred to them. But Josephus also counted Tyre as an Israelite city. And that's also in against Appian. That's a good little book that he wrote against Appian. It was basically a retort to a Greek philosopher.
Josephus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the shortest of his three major books.
Mm.
Well, you remember when Yahweh told the Edomites that they withheld the children of Israel from entering into the kingdom. Not only Yahweh keeping it a mystery, but, you know, the Edomites, obviously, I think for a large part, were involved with that subversion, obviously.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, the Jews are the record destroyers from the beginning.
Well, yeah. No, that's why I say I don't think, no, if Yahweh so much the one who's making it a mystery.
Well, it was prophecy that we would be blind. Who is blind but my servant?
Yeah.
It was prophecy that we would forget who we are. It's a matter of,
mm-hmm.
I got my notes on that. I got notes on that sitting on my desk here that I wrote 10 years ago that I'm going to do a program on one night. It's just matter of getting it together. I mean, it might take me another 6 months, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
This weekend I'm going to have, I think I'm going to have Greg Howard on Saturday. Eli's off, so we're not going to cover Galatians. We're going to cover whatever Greg wants to talk about.
I had a thought, Bill, on Enoch, the book. How much older is that than the subsequent books that were accepted and canonized by the...
Well, I'd like to believe, and because the apostles testify that at least parts of Enoch belong to Enoch, but not the whole book of Enoch as we know it, because the book of Enoch as we know it includes other books which are definitely referred to in the Dead Sea Scrolls as the Book of Moses, the Book of the Giants, and somebody took a whole bunch of books. It might be five or six different books. And combined them all in later times into what became known as one Enoch today. But it's really five or six different books. But I believe that the apostles quote the earliest parts of it. Yeah, you know, around chapters, in Charles's translation, I think around chapter 15 or 16. I'd have to go look at some of my papers to know for sure. But the parts that Jude and Peter quote and allude to are the earlier parts of one Enoch. And that definitely has to date from the time of Enoch. The apostles believe so. So I don't see any reason to doubt them. I think it would be folly to doubt them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Epistle of Jude is half of it's right from Enoch. Half of that epistle, easy, is right from Enoch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, is part of that those writings were they? Very the earliest writings, biblical, so-called biblical writings then, that have come down to us?
Well, that's very plausible. Yeah, you know, I don't like to speak about it with certainty because we really don't know, but that's very plausible. Jude 4 through 12 can be compared with 1 Enoch 15:1-10 and 1 Enoch 16, and Jude 6 can actually seems to be a reference to 1 Enoch chapter 53. I'm looking at the Greek of my the notes in my Greek Jude. Jude 14 appears to be related to 1 Enoch 2, and 1 Thessalonians 3:13 talks about the same thing. But Jude is very closely interwoven with Enoch.
I wonder why.
Because Enoch talks about things that, you know, were basically the things that Christ said were kept secret from the foundation of the world. He came to reveal things that were kept secret from the foundation of the world. That's where guys like Jesse or Lee are wrong. Jesse Lee said that, Christ never said anything that wasn't in the Old Testament. Well, he says a lot of things that aren't explained in the Old Testament. And he says that, you know, a man who's inspired by the Word of God takes things out of his treasury, both old and new. Takes things out of the treasures of his heart, both old and new. I'm paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he came to reveal things kept secret from the foundation of the world. And part of that is basically the identification of the Genesis 3 serpent, which after the Genesis 3 account, I mean, sure, we have Cainites and we have Kenites and we have Canaanites and Edomites, and we could trace this line down to the time of Christ, but we wouldn't really be able to identify the Genesis 3 serpent if it weren't for the book of Revelation and for Luke chapter 10. And for John chapter 8, the Old Testament really doesn't talk about it. It really doesn't say anything explicitly. And I believe, David talks about the sons of wickedness, and that's only a glimpse of what the truth is. I mean, it's an edifying glimpse, but it's only glimpses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the dark side wants to keep that out as much as possible.
Well, of course, the serpent side of the equation. And that's why, you know, they say Judaism doesn't teach there's a devil. Well, it doesn't. Because they are the devil.
They are, right.
If you were the devil, you wouldn't teach about him. Yeah, so there's a lot of new stuff in the New Testament, but it's based on the Old Testament. It's a revelation of the Old Testament in many ways.
Ooh, Jude, you said, wrote a lot about. He did a lot of quoting and reiterating Enoch.
And most of the quotes from Jude, from Enoch, are basically. Quotes that would lead to a racial awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that somebody said the other day in one of the programs about Enoch that might have been Eli talking about it's a good thing they left it out because the Jews didn't want to fool with it. It was not brought in as canon, you know, so there wasn't any attempt then to corrupt it, you might say. They let it alone, thinking it wasn't going to be read anyway. Is that, do you consider
that?
I don't,
let me talk about that. There's a lot of fragments to Enoch in the Dead Sea Scrolls, okay? And it's bits and pieces. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And there's a lot of fragments to Enoch in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But basically, the Enoch that we have went probably from, I'm going to guess, from Hebrew to Aramaic. And then it was preserved in the most unlikely place. It was preserved in Ethiopia. And there was, at one time, probably a legitimate white Israelite or Adamic Christian assembly in Ethiopia. But those people mixed with the black tribes. And they actually did preserve this book of Enoch for many centuries. And we owe them at least some debt for that. that, you know, there has to be some divine hand there to preserve that book to us. Because it was discovered in the 1800s, and it was translated by Charles, who was a pretty learned man, and it was translated by Lawrence, whose edition I don't think isn't half as learned as the Charles edition, but that's besides the point. That now this it was preserved in Ethiopic because when it fell out, when it was taken out of the canon, when it was deemed non-canonical at Nicaea, well, the scribes, it wasn't suppressed, but the scribes would just simply stop copying it. Because the scribe, you know, being a scribe is a business in the ancient world. And you're going to make copies of things that you can sell. That's what they made copies of. And if they had books that nobody wanted because they were no longer considered canonical and they couldn't sell them, and books were very expensive, so people were only going to buy what they need, they wouldn't make copies of them. So a lot of ancient books that were good books disappeared simply because there wasn't no commercial demand. There wasn't any commercial demand for them. Yeah. Herodotus talked about writing a history of Assyria. We don't have a whit of it. Strabo wrote a history. I mean, Strabo wrote a 12-volume geography. I read it. But he also wrote a history. He wrote a history before he wrote a geography. But we don't have a speck of it. For some reason, his history just never took off. His geography did. There's a lot of great ancient books that I read about that I can't have because they're gone. Or there are only bits and pieces of them. It's you know, we've lost an incredible body of literature since in the last 3,000 years.
Well, what do you think about, that's interesting, what do you think about the speculation, which I know nothing about except from what I've heard on various talk programs, about they talk about a library somewhere near the pyramids, the Sphinx.
That's only speculation. That's freak speculation. Edgar Casey's a straight freak.
Oh, I don't know, but yeah, I wasn't bringing him to mind.
And I don't know of any ancient testimony. I don't know of any ancient testimony
for
that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Wesley Swift believed it, but I don't know if he was following Edgar Casey or if he really read something in the Zohar. I can't say. But as far as I'm concerned, it's like you said, speculation.
Yeah.
And Edgar Casey, following him is like following Zechariah Sitchin.
No, yeah, those guys are all over the place with their fantasies. I don't know. They may have some element of truth. I can neither prove nor disprove anything they say, except I can choose to go along with it or not.
Every novel has some elements of truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, every novel does. I've castigated guys, very intelligent men. What are you doing reading that damn novel? Oh, well, he bases it on real stuff. Well, go read the real stuff, you know?
Yeah. That's right.
All the time. Michener, he comes to mind. There's a few others that do good research, and then they write novels. Well, that just feeds the beast. That feeds the Jews. They should do good research and write good history.
I don't read novels. I don't read pockets. I don't read any of those myself. I know a lot of they've got book racks full of them around here, and I wonder how they make a living at it. I guess people like to read that stuff. Dime novels, they just call them. I just thought it might be interesting. There might be some of these books might be lying around somewhere in the library other than the proverbial Vatican basement. You know, there might be something somewhere that some of these things. It's hard to imagine that if there were such documents and knowing their value in those times, the man hours of work and labor that went into producing the original copies of it, you think somebody would have wanted to preserve it, and then there might be others that know it's preserved but don't want it to be out, so it could be hidden someplace.
Well, that leads me to finish discussing the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Now, these scrolls were located in the mid-40s and early 50s, and they were mostly in the hands of English and American and German scholars in Jordan, in the part of Jordan that we know today as the West Bank, in a museum that Rockefeller funded. So we know that there's always something up with that, right? But sometimes the Jews do something good by accident. It really does happen once in a while. Well, Rockefeller funded this museum, and they built it on the West Bank. Now, I don't think that's an accident that they built it on the West Bank, okay? I think that's the nefarious part. Well, anyway, American and German and English scholars studied these. I mean, Edmund Wilson wrote a book about the secrets of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1955, I think was the first book. Okay, these things were pretty well known. And in 1967, we had what, the Six-Day War, Seven-Day War? I think it was a Six-Day War because they probably wouldn't have it on the Sabbath, right? They had to finish it before the Sabbath. I'm just making
on
a
the
dumb
Sabbath.
Joke. Well, the Six-Day War, and the Jews took over the West Bank, and they took the museum that housed the Dead Sea Scrolls along with the West Bank, and they threw all the American and British scholars out and German scholars out, and they basically shut it down, and they only let a couple of Jewish scholars in. And for the next 25 years, only a few select Jewish scholars could even get in to see the Dead Sea Scrolls and do any work with them. And there was a book written by a Jew named Giza Vermes, and even he was a Jew, and he couldn't get in to see him, and he whined about it in a book. He made $1 million probably on a book whining about how he couldn't get in to study to write a book.
All right.
Now, in 93, they were opened up again to outside academics. Now, there was one scholar who was not a Jew who actually had an intimate knowledge of the Dead Sea Scrolls before and after 68 and 93, the 25-year period when they were shut out. And his name was John Strugnell, and he was a Catholic priest and a Harvard professor. And John Strugnell, after 93, when he got back in to see the Dead Sea Scrolls, he basically said that there was an entire copy of an Aramaic Enoch that disappeared. And when he made that public, he got branded an anti-Semite. He got drummed out of Israel. He could never go back to Palestine to see the Dead Sea Scrolls again. I swear. And all he said was they hid the Book of Enoch, basically. Where is it?
They took their time. Did no one see that before 68 when they threw him out?
He saw it. He saw it. That's how he knew it was there.
Oh, he saw it before 68 then. So,
yes.
Yeah,
and he didn't see it after 93. He wanted to know where it was.
And he's been ousted.
Well, he was excoriated from Palestine, yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Why am I not surprised?
I'm curious as to what do you think is behind the readmission of the Goyim, or whatever you want to call them, back into their secret holdings there on the Dead Sea Scrolls that they now own or think they own?
Well, there was a lot of pressure for many years about that. So I guess they have to cave in once in a while.
After they've done what they want to do and put away what they don't want to be seen.
I'm certain. Okay. I am certain. Yeah, you know, the Jews, they're not going to change what's there. They're sure as hell going to hide what they don't like. I have no doubt.
Oh, yeah. I would doubt that for a minute. They'll let out what they can control, the information.
And, you know, in defense of yeah, you know, most scholars are honest most of the time, and in defense of things, yeah, you know, we say if Enoch didn't if we didn't have Enoch, we wouldn't have it, you know. If we'd had Enoch, it would have been perverted by the Jews, and that's not necessarily so. I don't necessarily agree with that, because 99% of the differences in the New Testament manuscripts are dialectual or simple scribal mistakes or simple changes in spelling or misspellings. There's a couple of cases or tenses in Greek verbs that when they're uttered vocally, they could be mistaken for each other. It's easy to mistake the aorist for the imperfect in a lot of Greek verbs. And things like that. You know, the length of the noun changes and you have an imperfect instead of an aorist and you write the wrong word, right? And it's a was instead of a has been or whatever. It's that most of the differences in the New Testament are very insignificant. There's a couple of major additions that are nefarious. The last 11 verses of Mark 16, for instance. And parts of 1 John 5, 7 and 8, where, you know, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, three that bear witness, you know, the Trinity verse, which doesn't belong there.
No, that's a...
You know, there's a couple of place things that were added in the New Testament that are really, really nefarious, that are really bad and done purposely. But they weren't added into all the manuscripts, and the oldest manuscripts don't have them. And fortunately, through archaeology, we have enough witnesses to eliminate and most of the additions, or perhaps all the additions, through archaeology and textual criticism.
And your publication of the New Testament will be as you see it, not as it's. You're going to leave out the extraneous stuff that's been.
Well, my publication in the New Testament, my translation is as I see it, and
right.
I basically tried to follow. Well, I did follow only the oldest manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
But quite often, it's a judgment call. Well, when you have the Codex Vaticanus and the Codex Sinaiticus, which are probably the two best oldest great uncials, and they're both from the 4th century. And very often they agree where the Codex Bazai and the Codex Alexandrinus, the Alexandrian textual tradition, and that's the things that the King James is based on, by the way, where those things are you know, have a totally different reading. But sometimes the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus don't agree. And it's really pretty difficult to determine if you don't have an ancient papyri that testifies to the verse one way or the other. It's a judgment call very often. So I made judgment calls, but I don't have them available on my website, but I got 2,550 footnotes in my Luke translation that explain a lot of those judgment calls. And I got 1,250 footnotes in my Paul translation where I explain a lot of those judgment calls. And I give the alternate readings. So hopefully one day I'll get all that online too, but or get it published would be better, but.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. It's a matter of time. I mean, I've only been home for 15 months and look at my websites.
Yeah, great.
So I'll just keep plugging, do what I can.
I was looking at your website last night at the pictures that Moniker had put online.
Oh, he's done a great job. He's done a wonderful job putting those up.
That is just after my birthday in 1940, some of those photographs came in of the Germans rescuing sailors on April 7th, 1940, the photographs came in.
Right, it proves that the propaganda is disgusting.
Yeah.
And what about the, he put up a Life magazine issue where it proves that they were planning for war against Germany in 1938.
It's right
on the front page of my Mein Kampf site. Getting ready for war against Germany and Japan. The date of that issue is 1938. And these two bastards have removed all of that from the public consciousness by drowning us in media BS about some kind of phony-ass Holocaust that never happened.
Oh, yeah. Terrible. 60 million, is it? Or what is it? 6,000? 6 million? Yeah.
6,000 is more like it.
Probably. Yeah. Goebbels' speech, and you and Brian were talking, I think it was a week before this one.
Yeah, we finished it last night.
Yeah, and what was the point? There was something at Brian started reading first 2 weeks ago, and partway through it, there was a question I had on something that Goebbels gave in that speech as far as his, maybe it was the awareness of the Trinity part? Where was Goebbels on that?
I don't even think that he had an opinion on it. I don't know. I could be wrong. I might have to go back and look. I mean, the speech is online, and it's all searchable.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. If you want to point out the passage to me, I'd be glad to address it.
I'll have to look for it. But this thing is too slow to do it while I've got the other stuff going.
I'll tell you, Adolf Hitler from Mein Kampf, in Mein Kampf, he definitely knew that the Adam of the creation of Yahweh was the Aryan man. He was fully aware of that. There's no doubt. And he definitely knew that the Jew was an interloper. He was fully aware of that. There's no doubt. And he calls them serpents and vipers. He was two sea lion and everything but name. But he didn't have the actual historical documentation. He just knew it from his heart because he was a good Christian. And to hell with what the Jews say. Adolf Hitler was a good Christian. And he believed his Bible. And Mein Kampf proves it. And all of his actions prove it.
Oh, yeah, his Mein Kampf is remarkable. I remember years and years ago, you'd talk about these Aryan nation brotherhoods and all that, and all they were Nazis, and they used the word Aryan as though it was it was intended to be a bunch of, you know, they put them across a bunch of misfits and just roustabout kind of people, and that Hitler was the epitome of all that, and he started all this stuff going about the Aryans. No relationship connection given between the word Aryan and its historic meaning. It was like the Second World War. Now, what is it all about the Holocaust and museums? It was just a bunch of hype, a bunch of stuff put out there, propaganda put out against nationalism, for one thing, I believe, in this country. And what Hitler was doing, they were modeling people that understood. I believe that the people that do the Aryan nation, the white nationalist thing, they understood what Hitler was doing. But then their message and their ideas were perverted by the popular press in this country.
There's a lot of power in the press. There's a lot of power in the media. And 99% of people that walk the land in this country today, 99% of what each of them know comes from that media. And a Jew is behind every ounce of it.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's persistent. I get emails from people that are telling me, you know, they're trying to send the message that we've got to think differently now. We've got to look at Glenn Beck, and he's got the great message for us. A very good friend.
He's a race-mixing clown. And I listened to Glenn Beck all the time I was in prison. I listened to him, and I listened to him time and time again set up one of the right-wing so-called conspiracy theories. He would set it up and he'd really go out there on a limb to the extreme and knock everything out from underneath it to discredit it. He exists solely to discredit conservatism and the right wing in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very cleverly and diabolically done. They think that way, and he's probably got a team of people working, you know, to make sure he gets every emphasis point, and everything's done just to a T. But people don't see it. When it's presented to them, it's like they go to a movie and they watch the thing is laid out before them, and they see all these scenes coming up, and pretty soon they're hypnotized and they're into it, believing it, and they know it's only a story, or it's what's being presented as somebody's idea, but that motion picture, the script, the constancy of presentation in a formatted way that's designed to drive a point home, it works. and they come out, you know, come away from these programs, whether it's on television or out of a theater house, they come away convinced they've just been elevated in consciousness and revelatory experience. The truth is, you know, and you can't talk to them about anything else. With a lot of them anyway.
Right. You could never explain to one of them that Glenn Beck's a sham. He's a straight sham. And he's going to lead them down the same path into the global New World Order, just like the Democrats are pulling us from one direction, and the Republicans, so-called phony conservatives, are pulling us from the other.
Yeah.
And it all ends up in the same place.
Right. Right where they were headed in the first. It's the left wing and the right wing, but that's what's flying in the body of the bird, and the head is controlling it. And the bird gets to where the head wants to go in the first place, whether there's a little disruption of the left fluttering or the right fluttering, it still goes where it's aiming, where it wants to go. It's got its
eye on. Absolutely. That's why no matter what party's in control of the White House, the same agenda passes. Agenda gets pushed forward.
Right.
And this should have been evident to most thinking people 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. They don't. I swear, people just won't. They put up a shell or something around themselves.
Well, that's why I wrote, there's no political solution, and there ain't one. And I'm not the first guy to say it, believe me. But there ain't one. We can't, you know, we get tricked, and even a lot of people in identity and people in this forum, that they get tricked into thinking, oh, let's vote for this guy or let's vote for that guy. Ain't none of those guys running for anything that are going to help any of us.
No. Nope. Well, Bruce and I were talking about that. We don't need a king. We don't need a ruler. That's what they wanted. Our people and the Israelites early on wanted. They want to give us a king, right?
Well, yeah. That's the source of all our worldly problems.
That's the problem. And then all these Christianity people coming out and saying how wonderful it is, and we're going to vote. We're not going to vote for Obama people anymore. We're going to vote for good people. You know, they're into that. They've been duped, and they don't realize it. And they've taken the story out of these churches, hook, line, and sinker.
Well, for the last 15 months, I've gotten a lot of email from a lot of so-called identity pastors that, and it's all political mail. Oh, look at what Obama's done. Obama, we got to do this. Obama, we got to do that. Oh, no, we don't. Who cares a damn about Obama? Let him sit in the White House with those four or five kikes. And let them do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah.
It don't matter.
That's right.
He's illegal. So what? Mm-hmm. He's not illegal. It's the damn Jew that makes the law. The Jew that makes the money makes the law. I don't know how he could be illegal, because it's the Jew that wanted him in office.
Yep. They paid for it. I mean, we paid for it.
The Constitution doesn't matter one hill of beans. And it hasn't mattered in 100 years. It hasn't mattered since the Jews started making the money.
Yeah. Yeah, the money and things are overlooked.
We have no salvation in the political process whatsoever. Our only salvation is in repentance and in Yahshua Christ. Period.
Absolutely.
We're not going to vote our way out of this. We're not going to fight our way out of it. We got to repent our way out of it. That's the only way. And when Babylon falls, then it's our turn. But we can't do any. We're going to have no power until Babylon falls. Period. I don't care how many guns, tanks, how many militia you think you got. We ain't going to do nothing until Babylon falls. That's the written word. And then it's our turn.
Go over that a little bit, would you, Bill, please?
Well, that's the scripture. You know, Revelation 17:17. I will give them one heart and one mind in order that I turn their kingdom over to the beast. And this is the time we're in. And if Yahweh said that he was going to permit our kingdom to be turned over to the beast, there ain't no way that we're going to resist that. And we're told that Babylon's going to fall under its own weight. And none of us are going to get credit for making it happen. It's not going to happen.
That's it. That's it. I think it's that concept that you just explained, that he's going to turn it over, that kind of puts me at peace and understanding that no matter what they're doing, I mean, I can say all I want all day long to people, And some might be casually agree a little bit this way. I've got a friend here that we're pretty much agreement on things, one guy that I know. But the rest of them, you know, I can see, I see it as it, as you just quoted Revelation. That's, I see that as what the situation is, and it, there's nothing we can do about it. Nothing.
No, and we don't deserve to be able to do anything about it because we are the whore.
Yeah.
And I don't mean the people in this forum. Most of the people in this forum have probably come out of the world. But we collectively, as a people, we are the whore. We're the bride in the end, but we're the whore now. And if you don't believe that we're the whore, go look at a crowd at a football game. Go look at who's streaming into the movie theaters to give the Jew their $10 for their 2 hours entertainment.
Bill?
We are the whore. Yes, Bruce.
Oh, when our prince says, come out of her, my people, all that he's saying is stop being a whore. Right?
Well, basically, right.
That's it. Because we played the whore for so long, and, yeah. That's all it means. It means stop being a whore. Stop buying all those, you know, supporting all of these immoral
activities. Not making the
activities.
Devil rich.
Yeah.
Go look at, go stand outside of Blockbuster and see who's renting all those porno flicks. And you'll see white man after white man walk out with them.
Yeah.
We are the whore.
Mm-hmm.
We deserve to be.
Yeah.
They've gotten in, mixed in with a crowd of lemmings, and it's hard to get out of the midst of them when they're going over the cliff. You know, it's just all going that way.
And it's the same story as Genesis 3:15, where the seducer, the beast, seduces Eva, who is the whole, you know, not that, well, it's the same thing going on. All the whole story from Genesis to Revelation.
Yes, it is. Well, anything else? Anybody else going to call in here? I mean, there's got to be 25 people in the forum. Somebody's got to call in.
How many people are in now? 45?
No, about 25, maybe 30.
25?
I don't count. Don Brown's going to call in. Don, I know you're out there. You got to call in. It's almost St. Patrick's Day, Don. I don't know if you're guest number 7, guest number 8, or guest number 9, but you're one of them. I don't know. What else do you have for us, David? You're bailing me out tonight here. I mean, this is an open forum, but nobody really gets it that to have an open forum, you got to have more than one person, right?
Yeah, it'd be nice. My screen is frozen. The last thing I've got on there is from Rick Tarr. It says, hey, Gerald and sniper woman Patricia. That was the beginning of the program.
Yeah, I guess so. You just froze up. I'm sorry. You need to buy yourself a better computer. I mean, I know that the money goes to Babylon too, but we need our tools, right?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't usually do this. I don't know. That's strange. I could shut that down and start it up again. It might work or reload it or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm just not into the forum, but I can't type and talk at the same time and listen.
Well, it's I've done it on occasion, and sometimes I'm trying it. Eli catches me with my proverbial pants down because I kind of miss what he says or just slack up for a second. And he asks me a question, and I'm like, hopefully I cover it up pretty good though. Nah, it happens once in a while that he catches me paying too much attention to the forum when I think he's given a long spiel and it don't go quite as long as I hoped.
Yeah, I can tell sometimes I hear you doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's hard to watch the forum and do the program it is. And sometimes I can pull it off.
I'll mention a friend of mine in Florida. He used to be my school teacher in 1948. His name is Richard Moeller, and he'll be, I think he just last month or so, I think he was 93, and he's a Baptist and a Methodist. he has some name, a Methabapt or some Methabath or something they call it.
Yeah, they're going to be anything but a Christian. That might necessitate reading the Bible.
Out of approaching, but he's when he was 7 years old, I may have told you this story once before, but his grandmother taught him. He memorized Romans 21 verses. He memorized the whole thing when he was 7 years old.
I dry everything. I just put it in the dishwasher to dry.
I'll just let Patricia talk about her dishwasher in private. I'm sorry. I don't think she realized I unmuted her, but we don't need to hear about her dishwasher. That's okay, Patricia. You probably didn't even know I unmuted you. I didn't want you talking about your dirty dishes on the program. Hello.
Good.
Well, somebody's got to give the orders around here.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Hey, I've got a couple questions. One is, you know, you're talking about how we're the whore, but we're not the great whore of Babylon.
Yes,
right?
We are.
We are?
Yes,
That's the church is that.
We are the church. The church is the assembly. I mean, the organized religions have helped us along the way. There's no doubt. But it's our fault. We're the ones that go to the church.
Take full responsibility, but I don't see us as that whore. You know, we're the unfaithful wife. There's no question that unfaithful wife whore, same thing. I agree.
It's a hard realization, and we like to blame it on the Catholic Church, and they share a lot of the blame because their doctrines and their teachings have been wrong for 1,500 years, and we like to blame it on the Protestant churches, and they share a lot of the blame, but they are us. Us. They are us. I mean, our people, those churches, our people succumb to those doctrines.
Yeah,
many of them help make them.
We don't need the Jews. We fight amongst ourselves. What do we need them for?
Well, the false doctrines, universalism, all that, if our people read the book and studied, they wouldn't fall for the tricks of the Jews.
Exactly. But, you know, it's our judgment.
Yes,
I mean, our blindness is our judgment, just like you said. So, no, I was just, okay, well, I thank you for clarifying that. And since it's almost St. Paddy's Day, you know, and we all know what's Irish and stays out all night, but I just wanted to ask about the Culdee Church and if there's anybody that can really give me a great explanation of that. And if you can't, Bill, I'd be surprised, but I wouldn't hold it against you since you're into everything else, but what about the Culdees?
Well, it was an Irish-Scottish church that existed long before the Roman Catholic Church and long before the Romans ever brought Christianity, which they never did, to the British Isles. They brought Catholicism to people in the British Isles that were, many of them were already Christians. But the actually, the real competition was when the Angles and the Saxons came into Britain, whether they were going to be Christianized by the Irish Culdee priests or by the Latin Catholic priests. That was the real competition. And of course, eventually the Latin Church won, the Roman Church won out, and that gets all the press, and they got to write the history. But when Augustine went to Britain, those people, there were already plenty of British Christians there, and that was the Culdee Church.
Exactly.
But eventually it was exterminated politically.
Right. That's my understanding, too. But I thought that the Culdee faith seemed to be a purer, you know, less liturgical.
Oh, it definitely was. And Bede writes about the contention between the Irish priests and the Catholic priests. And just reading Bede, who wrote in the 7th century, there's no doubt that this Irish church had come to be absolutely independent of anything in the Greco-Roman world. And that, you know, most historians will only trace that back to the 5th century. They won't take it before that. But it definitely existed before that. These people had a fully developed theology ever before the Latin Church was even recognized by the Caesars. There's no doubt.
Cool. That's what we had a question about the Druids too.
Well, you know, a lot of people like to say that they know a lot about the Druids, but very little is actually known about the Druids.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you know, we have traditions and some oral traditions that survived, and they're very scant. They're very thin. And we have what the Latin and the Greek writers wrote about the Druids. But all of those, you know, that they're very, very brief mentions of Druidism are made. But there's nothing, we don't know anything at length. Not that I've ever read, and I don't know if it exists. Anybody would like to be an authority on the Druids and wants to call in, I would be glad to have them. But I would suggest that he better have citations from old writing. That's all I ask for.
I've heard a lot of Gnostic clowns that tell us all about them.
Well, it was definitely a priesthood. The Druids were definitely a priesthood amongst the so-called pagan northern tribes. There's no doubt about that. And they're mentioned by the Roman and Greek writers. And I've mentioned them in my writings.
Well,
just like the Hebrews. I think I have a line somewhere that says that basically that just like the Hebrews wouldn't have a sacrifice without a Levite, neither would the Druids have a sacrifice without a Druidical priest. And the northern tribes wouldn't go into a war without consulting a Druidical priest. And you know, the Greeks did the same thing. The Greeks wouldn't go to war without consulting the men who were esteemed to be able to read omens and their own basically pagan priesthood. And they were also officiated sacrifices and things like that, very much like the Levites. And very much like the children of Israel would consult the Urim and Thummim, or Umim and Thummim. I'm sorry, I forget those two words. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
The two stones on the vesture of the high priest that they consulted to get answers. It was like an oracle. And that was probably the origin of all the oracles. I'm sure that tradition, that all the oracles of the Mediterranean world probably copied from that. That's my belief.
Well, I know people that defend the Druids and say that, you know, they worshipped in a grove just like Abraham.
Well, a lot of that worship in a grove is condemned in the Bible.
Well, some
it's
of that
condemned
is
in Hosea. It's condemned in Ezekiel. That's the pagan religion of the Canaanites is basically what it is. But you have to remember that the children of Israel were expelled from the land of Canaan, the land of Palestine, because they followed the religion of the Canaanites.
But the Bible tells us that Abraham in worship in it. It doesn't say he worshipped the grove. It just said he worshipped Yahweh in it.
Well, I understand that.
Well,
but they came to do a lot of pagan acts in groves, and that's definitely mentioned explicitly by Ezekiel and Hosea and several of the other prophets.
Yeah, I understand that, but I don't think we can count on the Romans to give us a clear indication of who the Druids were. They vilified all the people.
Well, you know something, we have to. And you know why? Because we don't have the Druids writing.
That's true. No, but we don't have to take that because there's a lot of inconsistencies in the Romans, right? You know, they called everybody who wasn't Roman barbarian. And we know that they weren't barbarians since one of the Parthians, barbarians.
Right, MacDog, that song. Well, no, because barbarian is not a slander, Patricia. barbarian is only a slander to us because we have this this Hollywood vernacular.
Oh,
but barbarian is not a slander in the ancient world. All barbarian meant, the Greek word barbarous only meant one thing, not Greek speaking, period. That's all it meant.
Oh, all right. So as long as they weren't villainizing me, because books I've read on the Celts and stuff say that the Romans just, you know, villainized them.
Barbarian meant not Greek speaking. That's the original meaning of the word, and that's the original way the Greeks used it.
Okay.
It later came to mean, yeah, you know, when the Romans took over the Greek world, when the Romans came to rule the Greek world, the word barbarian came to mean not Greek or Roman cultured, a culture other. But that don't mean it was a caveman dragging their women around by the hair. That, you know, that's not what barbarian meant.
Man, I miss those good old days.
The Greeks and the Romans actually wrote about the high level of sophistication that some of the and culture that some of the barbarians had. I mean, I read on a program not too long ago. I read Strabo's description when Eli and I finished up the Book of Acts. I read Strabo's description of Malta, and Strabo called them barbarians because they didn't speak Greek. They were actually Phoenicians or Israelites.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me that word also comes from the Berbers or the Barbers.
No, it has nothing to do with the Berbers. The word has nothing to do with the Berbers, I'm sorry.
Well, okay. Well, I put that out, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. But basically, yeah, you know, they wrote about the high civilization and the high culture of Persia and how it made the men soft, how luxury made the men soft, which is true. I mean, we see it today, right? And the Greeks understood that 3,000 years ago, that they wrote about the high culture, like I said, of Strabo, writing about the high culture and civilization of Malta. And he called them barbarians, but that was only because they didn't speak Greek. That's the only reason. It's not a defamatory term.
Okay. That's a great explanation, Bill. Thanks.
Okay. No sweat.
Yeah, words sure deceive us a lot, don't they?
Yeah, well, they do when we accept the, and we do, and I'm guilty of it myself. We all do it. We can't help it. We're pounded with this crap from the time we go to kindergarten until the time we come to an awakening, and sometimes it's hard to lose all the baggage. You don't lose it all at once. And Richtar said that we're not the whore because a lot of us have come out of the world, I don't mean us individually, Richtar. I mean us as a group, as a nation. I mean all
yeah.
of the collective white people together. And only a very small portion of us have even attempted to come out of Babylon, believe me. Well, basically, we're fed this crap. We're spoon-fed these poor meanings of words. It's the Jewish dictionary, basically, that we've been fed through Hollywood and through the media. That's why gay doesn't mean happy anymore.
Well, yeah. But, you know that word, universal, you know.
And,
universalism.
And that's just the most blatant description. That's just the most blatant example.
Yeah. I mean, that word really had a very beautiful meaning to it 100 years ago. And Bonfield in the 20s. What was that? Sexual revolution in Germany and Russia?
Yep, it started in Germany and Russia before it hit here in the 60s. It was there 50 years before it ever hit the Jersey Shore.
They had to move that Frankfurt school over here to mobilize their brain poisoning here.
And they did it. And Frankfurt school... Frankfurt School, I don't want to call them academics, Frankfurt School shysters were actually the instructors of many of the 60s revolutionaries. We proved that.
Mm-hmm.
Lord Brother and I.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin McDonald wrote about it again, 10 years before I ever studied it. That's why it was such a good thing to do that interview with him.
Yeah, that was a great interview. Well, that's all I wanted to talk about tonight.
Okay, Patricia, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, anybody else going to call in here? I mean, it's only 11:30. This program has been known to run till 3 sometimes. I'm not saying that I want to do that tonight, but we could run it past 12. That'd be nice.
Gotta have an intermission, huh?
Oh, I don't need an intermission. I can probably run my mouth for 3 days. My voice gets raspy, though.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I was telling you about Dick Moeller down in, he's 92, 93 years old, and he, I thought it was, I read his, he sent a letter out in 2006. He says, wise men still seek the Christ. So I don't know what, but he was my teacher in 1948, and he wasn't a Jew lover, I know that.
Wow, you're revealing your age, David. Maybe you should slow down a minute. No, I'm kidding.
Slow down?
Your teacher in 48. I wasn't born until 60.
Oh, well. That's, neither one of us can help that.
Yeah, no, that's great.
he was the best teacher I ever had. The man is an absolutely brilliant teacher.
Now, this was postgraduate school? I'm kidding.
No, this was in 1948. I was in the eighth grade of elementary.
I was teasing. I was trying to make you even older than that. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, it'd be all right.
I couldn't pass on that.
That was good. He used to have ways of egging us on. He wouldn't let anybody slip by without succeeding. If he, you know, it was all humanly possible. But one of the things he did, I know about the Jews. He made a comment one time. We were. You ever hear of the Indian named Sacagawea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sacagawea.
He said, "I'll tell you." He said, "Now here's a way." He said, "Now here's a way you can." It was his, an historic event, a figure. Don't ask me to recall it now. I'd have to look it up again. But he said, "And here's a way you can remember her name, because people say, oh, I don't." He said, "Just think of Sacagawea, will you?" And so I knew that I've never forgotten that comment.
Yeah, that indicates his racial awareness, eh?
Somehow, yes, I think it does. And he was a Christian thinker. I mean, he propounds it greatly and talks about his blessings. Now, I don't know whether he's a true seed line or a Christian, but he's aware of it. And I'm going to write him, and I'm going to get onto it with him. I want to discuss it with him or mention it to him and send him some things. I copied one of your pages from your website, printed it out, an introduction. And you may get angry, you can huff and puff or something to that effect, paraphrasing your work. But in the end, you're going to have to face it or something to that effect.
Right. You can't change the truth.
Right.
You get mad, but you can't change it.
Right. I thought I'd send that to him and, you know, see what he has to say. So, anyway. But he did. He memorized. He said it when he was 7. She wouldn't let him get one thing out of place. He had to memorize it all 100%. It had to be accurate, completely true to the words in the book.
Great, but that's terrible.
Well, I thought it was remarkable for a 7-year-old boy. I think it had a profound effect on his life. He took those words and he had them ingrained. And from Paul's writing, and I don't know him that well, but I think this has certainly been a guiding light for him all through his life.
Well, and that's a wonderful thing, but I just know a lot of men that. They could recite 5,000 verses from the Bible, but they don't know the damn story, you know.
Yeah, I'm not saying, I don't know whether he does or doesn't, but I'm going to send along some information that if he is interested at his late age, you know, he may. He said he was aware, he knows something about it. I don't know how he takes to it. If he does,
that's great. No, I mean, it's never too late.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to think that it's never too late to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's a great attitude to have at any age.
Yeah. Well, his statement right on his little letter from, it was Happy New Year 2006, he and his wife, and he has, it says Merry Christmas, and he says, and it shows somebody riding out the camel with a star above in the sky a little bit, and it says, wise men still seek the Christ. That's his a little thing he put on the top of his letter.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was nice. Anyway, that's Dick Mulder. He's in Florida and Texas. They live in down there. So, and he still gets out and does carpentry work. He's healthy.
Yeah, you know, I have my 91-year-old grandmother's upstairs.
Uh-huh.
And she has one uncle still alive. And that's my uncle, Waldo. His real name's Charles, but we called him Waldo all his life. And he's 98. But Waldo's brother, Clifford, just died 2 years ago at 102.
Wow.
And Clifford lived by himself until he was like 95, 96 years old. He lived by himself. He drove. He had his own house. And he hit like 95 or 96, and he said, I got to give it up, and went and moved in with his daughter. And he lived until he was 102.
Yeah,
and I wish I got to see him, but I was tied up at the time, and it's I always wanted to see him again. I was always disappointed I couldn't. Well, anyway, my aunt Hazel, who was their sister, she lived until she was 101, I hope I take after my grandmother. But I mean, you could stay if you keep yourself healthy. Yeah, you could be cognizant. I mean, some of us are just fortunate, right? And we could be cognizant for a long, long time. But my grandmother does. Yeah, you know, these people were raised on pig and shellfish. I mean, they were from Massachusetts, right? And I mean, in Mass, Patricia knows you got to eat fried clams. I mean, you don't escape the clams, the Boston Bay scallops, and all that, the lobster. That's part of life. And my grandmother's raised on clams and pig. And I tell my mother all the time, you know, I kind of got my mother swayed over to the pork thing, you know. And she doesn't buy it anymore unless my grandmother asks for it. And I sit there and I say, how do you tell a 91-year-old woman who's as healthy as Jack LaLanne that eating pig's no good for her? I can't do it. I just can't do it.
Yeah. The hard sell, they say.
Yeah, absolutely. So at least twice a month I got to stay out of the kitchen and the dining room for dinner. I can't even stand the smell of it anymore.
Yeah, it makes me think it's unclean. I don't like the smell of it either. Something about it.
Yeah, you stay away from it long enough and you really grow to dislike it. It's like cigarettes, you know. When I quit smoking, and 5 years later, I couldn't stand the smell of cigarette smoke.
I just had a friend of mine tell me he had smoking. If anybody has a problem quitting, my friend Ray lives here on the island, he's getting into Christian identity too, and he's coming around. He said, "Eat well." Just a little aside, he told me the other night. He said, "David, just a few months ago, stuff you were telling me," he says, "I was ready to call you a liar and stuff." You know, I told him about Billy Graham and the temple priest or the White House priest, and wrote it, printed out some articles for him to read, and he handed it back and said, "Oh, this is absolutely wrong. It's a lie," you know. He said, but now, he said, "I've been listening to some stuff." He listens to this fellow. I mentioned him to you one time before. He's got a TV. I can't think of his name, but he's a propounder of the true seed line presentation. I watched him a couple times on some recordings. He's pretty much in line, but I don't listen to him a lot. I listen to you guys and you and Eli and Brian and so forth. And, but But anyway, he was telling me that he's really come around. He says, boy, he said, I can see it now. He said, all my life. He said, he was amazed. He was stunned and surprised at what he had discovered by just listening to it and studying it.
Great. That's great.
Yeah.
That's true. But you have to, you know, I think that a man really has to be called into it, because it's hard to find somebody that is adverse to it like that and is even willing to listen, to take the time just to lay his prejudices aside and listen.
Right. You know, he was into it. When he and his wife were together, living together, they held Bible studies in their house, and it was the churchianity type stuff. And they thought they were, they thought they were, you know, into it, I guess, you know, and learning about the Bible and more churchianity, and that's the way they went. And when I started talking to him about the identity message, why, he was skeptical, Mary, but he got onto a program on television, this preacher, the talker or whatever. And I can't recall. You've heard of him, but I asked you one time if you'd ever watched him, and you said you knew about him but didn't have time. Graham something, or I'm not sure. Anyway, he got into it, and he came back with revelation, and he revealed, you know, he said, I've really found out the truth about what's going on and where it's coming from.
Well, that's
so
great.
Oh, yeah. It really, it is good to find somebody that'll do it and, you know, go along and think.
There's nothing better than the awakening of a white man.
Yeah.
You know, and one at a time, we're going to get them. It might take 20 more years, and there might be a lot less white men by then, but it's going to happen.
The remnant, yeah. Yeah.
The last remnant was 8. Yeah, you know, and we always have to keep that in mind, that pray to Yahweh that maybe he'll leave us a few more this time.
The last remnant was what? I'm sorry.
8. I'm referring to the flood. I'm making an analogy.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. Well, we're in that time again, right? It goes around and around, the times.
Absolutely. It does. It only goes around and around because we don't learn the first time, so we have to go around again.
Yeah. Yeah. They tell you the truth, though, right out. As they lie to you, they tell you that history repeats itself to those that don't learn from it, or something to that effect, you know, the old saying. And immediately they start throwing the lies out so that you do repeat it again. But they apparently there's something in their makeup, in their style or something. They do tell the truth. They reveal the truth, part of it, anyway, and then proceed from there in plain sight. In other words, you know, that concept. They do it all in plain sight. That's where it's most obvious to not be seen, not be believed.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And identity doctrine lays there in plain sight. I mean, it's in Romans, it's in Galatians, it's in Corinthians. And people, they really want to deny what the words say, because they're so well trained by the Jews.
Yeah. Yeah. It's astounding. I never would have believed, you know, it's hard for me to conceive of how people can't just say, oh, you mean the Jews are from, oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, okay, well, I'll quit doing this then and quit going to this church. I would think they'd fall right out of it that easily. I mean, that would be my, you know, you show somebody the truth, you'd think they would adhere, you know, say, oh, okay, well, thanks for showing me that. I didn't know. But they don't. They resist it. They resist it. And what was it you were calling it? Bruce, you're still there. You're the little eye or something, and it stands in front.
Well,
you know, there's the truth. Yahweh said he's the truth, the life, the way. And the thing is, he was pointing out the truth about what's false. And, you know, the Jews have brain poisoned us to think that we're being negative and insensitive and all this BS. But the fact is, you know, if you're going to get into, if you're going to be a real Christian Israel identity, receive the full blow of it. Don't play games, you know.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, PC is public cowardice. That's what PC is.
Yeah. I mean, that little thing called that I'm so concerned about saving inside of me, that's our whole problem. I mean, if we're just concerned with that, we played into the Jews' hands. That's what I was trying to get across, Dave. That
he who will save his life shall lose it, and he who would lose his life shall find it.
Yeah. But walking in the Spirit demands a lot of all of our energy, our heart, and our blood. Not just, and I'm talking about myself, not you folks or anybody else listening. I mean, one has to take it. Receive the full blow, but don't play games with Yahweh. He's not a plaything.
Well, most people like to treat him like one. They pick him up on Sunday morning and shake him around for a couple hours and throw him away until next week.
Got
that.
That's
what happens.
Good. And I think the Jews supply enough humor, I mean, as far as, but, you know, it's not funny anymore, you know. What they're doing is some serious business going to be going down, and people are going to be receiving the full blow of it, or they're going to be stuck in their fear and their little...
I'm ashamed of most of that dumbass shit I laughed at when I was a kid. I'm ashamed of thinking that I laughed at that now. I just want to take a chainsaw to the Three Stooges.
Oh, I might say something. Yeah.
Three Jews, three kikes, teaching white kids how to beat each other up. That's all I look at them as.
I could never stand the stupidity of that crap.
A total lack of respect for humanity is all they
do. Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. Talking about humor, Jew humor. The Moniker postings on your site last night, the comics, French comics?
Yeah.
Did you see who the artist was?
I haven't. I'm going to spend a good deal of time in April, I hope, on the
Well, it's just, he had it. I read the name. I use a magnifying glass, I think, on the screen. But I was wondering who was drawing all these big-nosed people tied up to stakes and stuff with their big noses. They had them staked out like a halter. And I noticed the artist was a Romanian Jew, Saul.
Incredible.
Can't think of his last name now, but it's on there. And I think it gives a little story about how he you'll read. It's very touching. Yeah, very touching. Such a sensitive, concerned human being he is. You're going to pick up on that little blurb on the artist that did some of those cartoons.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them, but I haven't had the time to read them yet. And
yeah.
I know that he's done a great job with them, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His website, I'm doing some. His Muniker's website is gardner.christianity.org. But that's about to change. And he has a new site called gentlecynic.net. And that's, I'm going to put a link up on Christianity to it as soon as it's together. But he's done a great job for us on the Mein Kampf site on those images, that's for sure. And he's also helped me with a lot of books and a lot of other things. The protocols and so he found that the book that I was quoting from last night, it was great. And he just told me about it yesterday afternoon, and I went to his site and downloaded this book, and I'm like, this is perfect. This dovetails with exactly what I want to talk about tonight. And I quoted from it. I put it right on my site and quoted from it last night. I skimmed through and found a couple of very apt quotations, and I used them in last night's program, and that was that communism in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I just learned about that from him yesterday afternoon, and it was perfect for last night's program. I thought so anyway. I mean, I could be wrong.
I remember what was the name of that book again?
Communism in Germany.
It's
the story of communism in Germany, and it illustrates what the Germans knew what happened in Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution, and this illustrates what they were afraid of. They didn't want that happening in Germany. And that's why, that was the enabler for Hitler to rise to power. Hitler had to come to power, or Germans would have ended up like America did in the 60s. We had no Hitler here. Well, we had something close in Jack Kennedy, but he really was no Hitler. I mean, he was aware of the devils in the Treasury, there's no doubt. And he wanted them out, there's no doubt. But that they killed him for that alone. And what did America do in the 60s and 70s except roll over and play dead while the Jews took the country over? That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and it's like a thousand... How many different countries did the same thing Uncle Adolf did and Serbia did to save our butts and to give us this opportunity now to even talk about these things?
Well, absolutely. And Frenchman saying that it started, in the 1910s with the melting pot. And he's right. The Jews started the propaganda here. Israel Zangwill, who was a Fabian socialist, and a friend of George Bernard Shaw, he published and put the first performances of the Melting Pot on in 1911. And Clifton wrote about that in a tract available on Clifton's site called "They're Your Children, Do You Care?" And that's how soon the Jews were spreading the race mixing propaganda here in America, 1911.
What was the name of that? Do you have that book on your site, Bill?
Clifton, it was a Broadway play. Clifton.
Oh, no, I know. Oh, I'm sorry. I was referring
to EmmaHeiser.Christogenia.org. Go there and do a search for Zangwill, Zangwill, and you'll come up with a paper Clifton wrote called "They're Your Children, Do You Care?"
I was referring to that book, Communism.
That's on the Mein Kampf site. And the link's right on the front page right now, right under that Judea Declares War on Germany newspaper article.
Oh, good. So people can... Okay.
And it's on the menu on the right-hand side, right under Russia number one.
Oh, thank you. Good.
And it's a PDF file. It's a 148 megabyte PDF file, but it's worth the download.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you also had that book on the site, The Jews in Russia and the USSR. The Jews in the USSR. Also, along the same lines, I think.
Yes, it is. But that's in the USSR and it's not in Germany.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's just describing who it is, who the enemy is, just another witness.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Municher? Is he in Germany?
No. I'll give you one hint. The theme of his website is race and crime in Iowa. That's all I'll say.
Oh. Okay.
Right. And I have no doubt Ginsburg was for sure a friend with Samuel Untermeyer. All of those bastards all were in bed together doing this business.
Well, of course they were.
Like a network, crime network, yeah.
That's exactly how they operate. And we let it happen. I mean, our people let them, it's our ancestors, right? I mean, my grandfathers were there, right in New York City. My family had a brewery right in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
kind of beer they brew there, Bill.
Enterprise Beer was the name of it.
Enterprise, yeah.
My family came over here from the same village at the same time with the Ruperts and the Schaefers. And the, one of the Schaefers is my great-great-grandmother, my great-great-great-grandmother.
Oh, Schaefer's Beer?
Yes. And Rupert and Rupert had a big brewery, and they owned the New York Yankees. And all three German families came from the same village in the Rhineland in 1836. And my uncle's still in touch with some of the Ruperts to this day. I have cousins that had box seats in Yankee Stadium for as long as the Yankees owned it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of German breweries around years ago. Were George Wiedemann.
If you go to WilliamFink.net, you can see pictures of my family gravesite in a big cemetery in Brooklyn, Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. And it's a plot cut into six pieces that six German families chipped in for. And the Ruperts and the Schaefers and the Finks are all buried together. And my family came here in 1836 but started a brewery in 1872 that my great-great-grandfather's brother inherited, and then it went down to one of his sons, August Fink. And August Fink is the avatar that I'm using on my Christigenia forum. That's him. He's the brewer.
You mean the picture?
Yeah, that picture of that I use on my Christigenia forum.
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my great 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 uncle. Maybe.
He's a Hebrewer. Is he in a uniform of some kind, a military?
No, that's my great-grandfather on my mother's side. That picture was taken in 1918 at Fort Devens in Boston. And he went through boot camp, and the war ended, and he never made it over there.
Yeah.
Good.
But I thought it was a cool picture. And the fish just wasn't the right dimensions, and it didn't look right. So I said, you know, I'm going to throw this up there.
Yeah.
Well, what else is happening? It's 12 o'clock. I mean, this I could pull the plug if nobody else is going to call in, or if we have no more really constructive conversation. I mean, I don't want to cut you guys short. I always got stuff I could work on.
Yeah, I like to hear you talk about different aspects of your research and the study. This history is intriguing and very interesting and enlightening. And I'm looking forward to your translation being published and put out. I want a copy of that.
Well, yeah, I'm going to start work on the appendices. I was going to start it today, but I just had too many little odds and ends I had to clear up. But I had I put an online store site up for a cousin. I got that running today finally, and I had to do some other work, and I got all that stuff out of the way now. So hopefully out in the morning. I'm going to start on my appendices, and I've got my mind to do it, so it'll be done within the next 3-4 weeks. I'll have a New Testament all ready to go within 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, it's ready to go. I just want to do the appendices, and I have to resize the manuscript. And that's some work. It's more work than you might think. It's probably going to take me 2 days to do that, to get it right.
Through the computer, the digital record, you mean?
Well, yeah, the manuscript is 8.5 by 11, and there's a lot of text boxes that'll have to be moved back into position once I resize the fonts and resize the pages to a book format. You know, it's drudgery work for a couple of days.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. So you'll be printing there in a few weeks.
Well, I hope to be. I mean, if I go to Lulu, I don't see why I can't be. So, I'm sure by the by tax time, I hope to be on Lulu. We'll see. I'm never going to get it done with a mainstream publisher because I don't have the time to pursue it, and because I've already been rebuffed a few times, and I'm just not the type of guy to drop. I'd have to drop everything and just work on that to hope to find somebody to publish me. I have a friend that's going through that right now, and it's a lot of work. It's incredible the things that these agents are making them do, and it's just ridiculous.
The hardship put before them, and they want to publish a book. I mean, is this just a stalling technique, or is there, what are they doing? Your friend?
Well, no, they're going to make you compete for a slot, you know, with all these other writers that want to get a book published. And they basically make you compete for that slot, and you have to maintain their attention, differentiate yourself, market yourself, market your book. That they want you to do all their work for them, basically. That's the way I look at it.
So you're competing, is that on an economic?
Well, yeah, you're competing for you know, if that publisher is going to publish 100 books this year, and there's 5,000 authors with books, you got to elevate yourself above the crowd. Yeah, you know, and they don't care about what the book is. They only care about the bottom line sales they're going to make. That's all they care about.
Yeah.
And that's a Jew game that I ain't going to play.
Boy. Yeah.
And I tried a couple of Christian publishers, but they don't want any part of me. I think that they've already, I think they're all wishy-washy, clued in by, I mean, I went to Artisan Publishing. Lynn Hoffman's a great guy, and I think he's sincere, but I think Ted Whelan's got his ear. I don't know. But I went to Artisan Publishers and a couple other places and didn't have any luck.
Well, as long as you get it out in print, that's the main thing. Whoever's going to do it, that's good.
Well, my first thought was to try to sell electronic copies, and well, the people that have bought electronic copies are going to be taken care of when it comes out. Don't worry. But my first thought was to try to sell electronic copies and raise funds to get enough books printed in that manner. But I'd have to raise about $2,000 to print 100 copies from the price. I got the pricing up online on ChrisDeGhenier.com. The quotes I got from one place, and they're all about, they're all roughly the same.
Well, I'm going to be waiting. I'm going to be looking for it. I'll sure be eager to get that, Bill. Because I don't, although you said tonight that most of the errors in the King James, I don't care to read that much. It's so convoluted in places. But you said a lot of the errors, are you saying that they're not necessarily intentionally?
No, what I'm saying is a lot of the differences in the manuscripts, there are definitely some things that were put into the manuscripts, additions made to the manuscripts. But most of the differences amongst the manuscripts, most of them are just unintentional. I would bet 90% of them are just unintentional scribal errors, and the other 10%, a lot of them are intentional dialectual changes. There's no doubt. Yeah, you know, to change words, they traded words for, you know, that were archaic for words that were more contemporary. And sometimes they traded dialects from like the coin dialect to the ascending in dialect and things like that. And sometimes, quite often, they just made mistakes. They just misinterpret the eta for the epsilon iota diphthong or the alpha iota diphthong. And that would change, very often change the tense of a verb, say, from the aorist to the imperfect, as an example. And it very often does. So most of those, yeah, you know, a teacher or a reader would recite to several scribes who would be writing down what he was reciting, and they would screw it up.
Ooh.
You know, that often happened. That most of the difference is, if you look at DNA 27 and you see 100,000 variations among different manuscripts in the whole New Testament, and I would bet 95,000 of them are incidental and really don't matter. But it's those couple of long editions that do matter, like the Trinity verse in 1 John 5, 7, and 8 that really ain't there. It's not in the oldest manuscripts. Or those last verses of Mark 16 or Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's not really in the oldest manuscripts. Not
is
there.
Is it in all of the publications, though, that are put out? Are those found in there? Those
Well, all the modern Bibles are basically based on the Textus Receptus. And that Textus Receptus, received text, that's really a printer's boast. That's not an official declaration by any governing ecclesiastical body.
I remember you telling me it's just the text that they received, right?
Basically, it's the Elzevirs got this text from Erasmus and reworked it a little and edited it a little and called it the Textus Receptus. Well, they were a bunch of Dutch, they were a family of Dutch printers that made that phrase up. A family of Dutch printers did that. They called it the Textus Receptus, like it's some kind of official official designation. It was a printer's advertisement is exactly what it was. Yeah, you know, it's like Barnes & Noble's putting out the Bible, and this is the real Bible. And you know, that's an advertisement. And then it becomes generally accepted that that's the real Bible. Well, get out of here, you know. Billy Graham's Living Bible is as dead as a doornail. And Billy Graham should be too if he ain't.
Yeah. 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 People revere that guy. Well, the Textus Receptus. Yeah. Citations you gave, now, it was in the Textus, so-called Receptus, where these errors then were carried forward. It was in that.
Well, the Textus Receptus, the only really ancient manuscript they had to work with was possibly the Codex Bizarre. And I like to call that the Codex Bizarre, because that has more departures from the other codices that are really out there that definitely, I mean, it's a very odd codex. Now, aside from that, most places where the Codex Vaticanus, the Codex Sinaiticus, and the Codex Alexandrinus disagree. And the Codex Alexandrinus is the main codex of the Alexandrian textual tradition. Most of the places where those three codices disagree, you'll find the King James following the Codex Alexandrinus, which definitely indicates to me that the Alexandrian textual tradition is, for the most part, represented by the King James Version of the Bible. And a lot of the King James translators try to twist that, and it's they just can't. I mean, they can't get around that. The supporters and the proponents of the King James.
Now, is there any that Alexandrinus is there?
There are a lot of variations in there that I don't accept. That I mean, they're so numerous, I would have to go through my notes.
Okay, that's what you're. You're getting that is that they took it from something that you found to be defective.
Oh, absolutely.
Ab initio, you might say. And
absolutely.
Okay.
No
yeah,
doubt.
All right. Yeah.
So, but when I talk about the New Testament, I really mean the Vaticanus, the Sinaiticus, the papyri that have been found. That they're, I favor them, and my translations follow them.
Mm-hmm. The ones that you know they're old and a genuine construct and haven't been tampered with.
Well, right. And I'll follow them all the time over the Textus Receptus. And it's quite often choosing between the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus. I'm going to be honest, it's a judgment call. And sometimes I go both ways. But I think if I have to look back and conjecture, I think that you'll find that I found the Vaticanus to be more reliable in Paul and the Acts in Luke, and I found the Sinaiticus I lean towards in Matthew and Mark.
Hmm.
And there's some ancient papyri that are very good, like 046, which is circa 200 A.D., which has most of Paul in it. And I always try to follow that or give the readings from it. And there's some other ancient papyri similar to that one that are very indicative of probably what the better texts are.
That's interesting.
I would like to one day take my translation and not toss it, but use it as a guide to help speed things along. Because I'm even though most of my translation was done 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years, I'm very confident in it. I would like to take it, and I would like to break out the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus and the papyri and make a sort of interlinear, you know?
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah.
But as you know, it's a huge task, and I don't foresee ever having the funding to do it. I'm being honest with you.
A lot of work. Now, why the differences between those two, the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus?
Well, you know, often they agree. Very, very often they're in agreement, but there are departures in various places.
Who was responsible for the creation of those two separate
documents? Well, we don't know the scribes, you know. We don't know them. The Sinaiticus, I'll tell you, the Vaticanus has basically been with the church for 1,500 years, for a long, long time.
Mm.
And it's a vellum manuscript, meaning it was written originally on animal skin, and that stuff is very durable, lasts a long time. But the Sinaiticus was basically found in a dustbin in their old monastery. Yeah, you know, it was kind of amazing that we have it.
Is that the 5th century? Oh.
Yeah, the Sinaiticus is generally dated to the 5th century, as is the, to the 4th century, as is the Vaticanus.
Oh.
And the Codex Alexandrinus and the Codex Bizei are generally dated to the 5th century.
Mm-hmm. And they were
And there's another codex called the Codex Ephraim Syri, which is very close to the Alexandrinus and it's also part of the Alexandrian textual tradition. And there are several other minor codices which do date to the 5th and 6th centuries. There's a Codex Washingtonensis that dates to the 5th century. And several others that don't have fancy names, not that are known to me anyway.
Well,
there's a Codex Claromontanus that's a 6th century codice. That has only Paul and parts that the Bizei is missing, and it's probably the other half of the Bizei from a different scribe, maybe, from a later copy.
Well, what's the root meaning of that word codex? Is that, I mean,
codex. It's a codex, I believe it's from a Latin word, which basically means a writing. I could look it up.
Oh, right here, a book, I think, yeah. A script or writing or
a... Yeah, right, but I had to look it up because, I mean, I took Latin for a year in school once, but that was 36 years ago. I don't remember.
That's like remembering what you had for dinner on February the 4th, 1983, right?
Well, yeah, right, but if they'd have named it after a Greek person, I would probably know the word, right? Codex, C-Codex, C-A-U-D-E-X. I got a Latin dictionary here. I wish I had the time to study it.
Well, one scribe might have been thinking of it as a verb and another as an adjective, and so...
A codex is a book, a tablet, or a ledger, or a blockhead. Because the word actually originally meant a trunk of a tree or a block of wood.
A blockhead, huh?
But it came to mean a book, a tablet, or a ledger. So there you go.
Mm, thanks.
That's what a codex.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think is the apparent cause, or if it's apparent or not, of the differences between the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus? Why... They got manuscripts.
It's hard to tell. I mean, it would all be conjecture. I'm being honest with you.
Yeah.
And the papyri, you know, very often follow one. You know, prove out but show or support one or the other. But sometimes the papyri support neither. Yeah, you know, but the difference is 99% of the differences have no effect at all on anything that I would consider doctrine.
Ah, okay.
It's the 1%, the additions, that do have an effect. And I have to reject them. Like the last 11 verses of Mark.
Like like the noodles, the meatballs, and the sauce, right?
Well, it's more like the noodles, the meatballs, the sauce, and the parsley. And the parsley was put on by an after cook, and you got to take that and throw it away.
Yeah.
You got to offload the parsley.
No kosher cooking, right?
Right.
I'm sure the Jew would love to split you in three or four pieces and call you by a different name. Or like any of us, too. Well,
I'm not too concerned about the Jew.
No, I'm not either.
Oh, by the way, today I turned down, and there aren't a whole lot of people left in the forum, but I'll share it with y'all. Today I turned down an invitation from Minister Kenneth Jenkins. I got to throw a little ahem in there after the I'm going to read this. It's funny. It's absolutely fruitless talking to the other races about race and religion. It's there's no fruit in it at all. And
no.
Yeah, you know, I don't have the kind of ego where I really have to go chasing down goats and telling them they're goats. I mean, I am. You can talk to a goat all day, and all he's going to want to do is chew some grass. I mean, he's still going to be a goat at the end of the day. It doesn't matter. Okay, where is this guy? Mr. Fink. Oh, this is Jam Radio Productions, by the way, Savannah, Georgia. Jam Radio Productions. It's Talk Shoe. My grandmother could get a program here. Okay. Mr. Fink, this is an invitation to appear on Nation Talk on Talk Shoe, March 21st, 2010, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The subject, Race Relations in the 21st Century, Part 2. It's a discussion on, I guess I wasn't invited to Part 1. It's a discussion on and about race relations and if it has improved or not, well, like I would care. There's still 100 niggers a day raping white women, so I guess it ain't improved, no? If you accept this invitation, please by all means send me an email reply letting me know if you're willing to be a part of this forum. I will await your response soon. Thank you, Kenneth Jenkins, blah, 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 blah. Okay, Mr. Jenkins, I must respectfully decline this invitation. I have no reason for, nor do I anticipate any fruit from, any conversation on the subject of race with people of other races. What do you think? Period. The end. That's it. That's all he gets from me.
Yeah. You don't want to cast your pearls with swine?
No, you don't cast your pearls with swine.
Oh.
And you can't let your ego get in the way. You just got to say, no, I ain't coming on your program.
That's
right. There ain't no use in it. There's nothing good that could come out of it. Period.
Yeah, exactly.
He's come on here. Jenkins has come on here from time to time, and the last time he came on here, he said, "Still spreading your vitriol, Mr. Fink," and I just muffled his ass.
Oh, you want to go on his program, don't you? Yes.
yeah, right. I don't get it.
Yeah, he's your vitriol. Come on. Jeez.
Yeah, I'd look like one of those clowns that goes on Jerry Springer, you know, in a KKK outfit or something. That's not me. It's just. I don't walk into setups just to tell people I was on TV.
You know, it's like Herod trying to have Christ do a miracle for him. The same thing.
MacDog, I don't know if I go. I wouldn't last 2 seconds on Alex Jones because I call him a Jew butt wipe as soon as I open my mouth. Because that's all he is. A Jew farce, and Alex Jones smells it. Somewhere in this world right now, there's a Jew farting, and Alex Jones got it up his nostrils. That's a line I stole from Clifton, by the way. I forget who he used it on, but it was pretty good.
He doesn't have a copyright on that, right?
He put it a little better, though. He said something about somebody stopping short and somebody else smelling the exhaust fumes or something. Yeah, I heard Mike Delaney call in Alex Jones, and Alex Jones was just went on a nasty. And Mike didn't say nothing. He asked him one stupid, simple question. And Alex Jones went on this nasty rampage. I got it somewhere on a recording. It might be on my site even. But
yeah,
Jones just made a total jerk out of himself. And Delaney was just being a nice guy. I was laughing my ass off when I listened to that. Because Jones really made a jerk out of himself.
Yeah, and Alan Watts was on that program with him at the time, by the way, Dave.
Alan Watts, yeah.
Yeah, and he was, you know, rubbing butts with Alex Jones there, you know, feeling sympathy for the Jew.
Right, McBragg, Jones is married to a Jewess, and that means he probably gets a lot closer to those Jewish butt fumes than we should probably repeat on a PG recording. Good night, McBragg. Well, I guess 2.5 hours is enough for this, maybe. I hate to cut it off because it's fun, but.
Yeah. Well, Yahweh bless you, David and Bill and everybody else.
Yahweh, yes. This is the Christiania Forum call, and thank you, everybody, for putting up with my banter for 2.5 hours. Good night.
Good night, Brian.
Good night.
And Bill. Talk to you later. God bless.